From the WIPZ studio on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, it's Parkside Today. I'm John Melke, and it is a real treat to welcome a person whose name is well-known throughout southeastern Wisconsin. He is a member of the music department faculty at Carthage College and host of the popular morning show on WGTD Radio. Greg Berg, welcome to Parkside Today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very honored.
And I think this is going to be fun. You've been hosting the morning show since 1998. How did the program begin?
Well, first of all, I came to WGTD in 1986, so that's how long I've been there. Wow. I was hired as fine arts director, and at that time, my primary responsibilities, and it was a full-time job back then, was to host all the classical music programming. And I did a couple of other things, had a music documentary show I kind of produced and something else on kind of the written word. And every so often, I would do a morning show. The morning show already existed. It had been created by our then news director, Bill Guy. But once in a while, if there was a musical guest that they wanted to have part of the morning show, Bill would call on me to do that. And so that's how I got my foot in the door in that sort of way, with a minimal amount of experience having ever really done that. And back then when I started, the morning show didn't even air every day. If Bill didn't have something, then we would just stay with NPR, the network, a little bit longer. But so maybe two or three mornings a week there would be a morning show, and it wasn't quite as long as it is now. But at some point, especially as budget cuts necessitated the restriction, constriction, I should say, of the staff, as we started losing reporters and began to sort of lose the ability to do other things, the morning show became kind of a centerpiece of what we were still able to do really well. So it eventually became every morning, eventually 8, 10 to 9 o'clock, and eventually Bill and I nearly split it in half. And when Bill tragically died of cancer in 1998 at the age of 50, the program was my sole responsibility from that point on. But I owe a lot to Bill. I watched him do what he did so well, and he ushered me into the ranks of the morning show, and I appreciate that.
Wow, interesting. So you've done thousands of morning show programs, and what is it about the show that keeps you interested, motivated, that each morning you say, yes, I'm going to get up and do the morning show?
Well, there's a whole lot of things I love about it. I hardly know where to begin. One of the things I love the most is that it's my baby, that it is something I get to put together with very little interference from anybody else. Mm. A lot of people ask me, oh, wouldn't you love to farm this out to Wisconsin Public Radio or maybe even NPR or you know, some kind of national outfit? And I appreciate those compliments. And maybe for a second or two, that sounds kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that's plausible, but it's maybe fun to dream about. But I quickly realized that I think I would be so frustrated to have to suddenly be beholden to somebody looking over my shoulder and so on. I love just being able to follow my own natural curiosity and kind of inquisitive spirit. And so that's where the program takes me. If I had to do kind of the same thing over and over again, it probably would become kind of a stale affair. Mm-hmm. But just by its very nature, it's sort of eternally new and fresh. As long as there's people out there saying interesting things or writing fascinating books, I'm privileged to be able to speak to them. So I just love doing it now more than I ever have.
Wow. And so you have, what, you've read hundreds of books probably in researching for your show. And,
oh, yeah.
and some of those books are on display in the Carthage Library. There's a Greg Berg book section in the Carthage Library, I'm told, by some of my sources at Carthage.
Yeah, they honored me. I don't remember exactly what the anniversary was of my years at WGTD, but I really appreciated that. And they made a point of purchasing a lot of the books where I've interviewed the authors. And, yeah, I've lost track. And it's interesting. Right now I'm in the process of transferring most of my personal morning show archives from compact disc to zip drive. And so just in the process of doing that, I'm sort of realizing the staggering number of interviews I've done over the years, and especially how many books that I've read. The thing is, it really would be a dull thing to do if I wasn't reading the books. If I was just bluffing my way off the dust jacket and so on, or asking generic questions, I can't think of anything more boring for me, or for the guest, or for the listeners. So it's well worth the time for me to read these books, or at least do heavy skimming, as I like to sometimes call it. But that's one of the best parts of the job.
So when you think back to different books that you've read for in preparing for the morning show, anything stand out as something where you looked at it and maybe thought, I don't know that I'm going to be really interested in this, but then once you got into the book, you found, oh, this is one that I really don't want to put down. Any surprises that you've had?
Right. That does come up. In many cases, too, it'll be something where I figure it's going to be pretty interesting, and I won't have any idea, though, how incredibly interesting it is. I think of Neil Bascom's book, The Perfect Mile, which tells the story of the race for the first four-minute mile, which was eventually run in 1954 by Roger Bannister. But there was another runner nipping at his heels, and they were kind of going back and forth in that struggle for whoever was going to run the first four-minute mile. I just couldn't believe the deep drama that was part of that, and I didn't know any of those details till I read that book. Another book, I can't remember the author's name, but it's called To Conquer the Air, and it's the story of the Wright brothers, which I knew that would be a fascinating story, but I had no idea of all the other people at the same time who were trying to achieve flight. And so that would be another example of a book that was probably 10 times more interesting, 10 times richer than I would have guessed when I first sort of cracked it open. And then there's other books where I would never have guessed that I would enjoy a book about mixed martial arts or something like that, that proves to be incredibly interesting. So that's one thing I'm really trying to do, is not limit myself to just the things I'm naturally interested in, but trying to make sure that I'm pushing past my own boundaries, so we don't do four days out of five about opera or something else that, you know, is already my own interest. I want it to cover a wide range of topics.
And I would think that's a little bit challenging to do that, isn't it? That it's easier to say, oh, here's something I'm interested in, or here's something that I kind of know about this, and you're more drawn to doing some of those, aren't you?
It's absolutely true, and so I really do resist the urge. I mean, I don't resist it entirely, because I think it also makes sense for me to do this program the best way I can, and for it to be my own. And so, so it really makes sense for me to spend some time talking about things like classical music or the U.S. presidents. That's been a huge interest of mine for many, many years. But otherwise, I actually find that sometimes it's easier to do the show when I genuinely don't know the answer to a lot of these questions. I mean, sometimes you already know the answer, and you feel like you're sort of play acting or kind of faking your way through asking questions, and you could answer the question almost as well as the guest could. So I love it when I'm talking to someone who is an expert in something that I am not an expert in. That in some ways feels almost the most natural in terms of this kind of format.
Do you find, when you maybe get into a situation like that, where you don't know where the interview or the conversation might go, and all of a sudden you're talking to someone and it goes in a completely different direction than maybe you even thought that would be part of the show?
Well, that happens, and that's one of the best feelings in the world. That also brings to mind, though, one skill that I think I have, I hope I do, which is being very split brain, because I think when you're doing an interview, it's important not to be so engrossed in what the author is saying, or whoever the guest is saying, that you lose track of the time, and you lose track of where are we now, and where do we need to go from here, and was that technical term he just said, is that going to be confusing to the audience, do we need that explained? And at the same time that you are the guest, I'm sorry, the host talking to the guest, you also have to be, in a sense, that editor from above, looking down at the interview as a whole and sort of figuring out where it needs to go from here. And for whatever reason, I'm pretty good at that. It's like I must have, I don't have the biggest brain in the world, but however big it is, it's, I think, split in two. Mm-hmm. And so that really helps me function pretty well. It's kind of the same thing as someone who's on TV and they have an earpiece and somebody is speaking into their ear.
Right.
While they are trying to smoothly talk on the air. And it's kind of like that, except I don't have anybody doing that. It's sort of my own voice saying, wrap this up, or we have time to stretch, or let's explore that a little more.
Right. Yeah, you hear that on television, especially with someone who may not be familiar with being interviewed, and they're talking along, giving an answer, and all of a sudden they stop.
Yeah,
and, right. And I'll say to Patty, somebody is talking in that person's ear, and that's a different feeling to be able to hear someone talking to you, giving you direction, and continue your conversation.
Right, and be able to kind of take it in and understand what's going on. And it's almost the same thing, and I think that's in some ways probably even trickier. So I like to think that I am pretty good at sort of having a sense of where this interview is going and where it still needs to go, and that sort of thing. And you're absolutely right, John, that when an interview kind of takes you into surprising directions, it's especially fun and especially mm-hmm. challenging.
Right. I took a look at your website. I like the title of the website, The Messy Professor, and that's messyprofessoroneword.com. So
right.
For those of you who want to go check out the Messy Professor website. And
it fits.
On your site, you indicated some of the people that you had the opportunity to interview.
Right.
Looking through the names. And one name struck me as, there's a person I would love to sit down and have a conversation with. So what was it like to interview Bob Newhart?
Ah, I was just listening to this interview this morning.
I mean, somebody's going to go, oh, he knew. And I didn't. I think Bob Newhart would be an interesting person to talk to.
I mean, he's a very sweet person. His persona off the stage or off screen is very much the same as he is on screen. So that was really nice. I mean, sometimes people are so different from the way they are on television. He was very, very nice. And he'd written a memoir. I can't remember exactly what it's called. Something like, I Can't Believe I'm Doing This or something like that. And it was really cute. My favorite Bob Newhart story is that after we hung up, after we finished the interview, I thanked him and he thanked me. And then I said, by the way, Mr. Newhart, I just have to say, you misquoted one of my favorite moments from your show in your book. And it's this moment where he goes on a talk show and the host turns out to be a really aggressive, nasty, negative host who just kind of viscerates the whole field of psychology. And it's a shocking experience. It's not what he expects. And there's a nun who comes on the show after him. When he gets back to the office, has all these messages from his secretary. And one of them is from the nun saying, wonders if he wants to go 50-50 on a hitman, because she must have had a rough experience too. Well, he kind of screwed that all up in his book. He quotes the joke, but he doesn't get it right. Mm-hmm. And so I had the audacity of correcting him, only because I love that moment. I can practically recite it word for word.
Sure.
And only after I hung up, I thought, why did I do that? I mean, I don't think he was, terribly distressed or anything, but, in retrospect, that wasn't my place to tell him
You messed up in your book, Bob.
Yeah, right. I mean, so there aren't a whole long list of things that I would erase from my career, but probably that little moment where I corrected Bob Newhart would be one of them.
Do that. And I'm sure with all of the different people you've had the chance to talk to, there are a ton of memories at things that you would recall and say, wow, that was really an interesting conversation or an interesting person. Anyone that fits kind of into that celebrity status where you look back at that and think, that was really fun.
Right.
I really enjoyed that.
First of all, I should say most of the time the celebrity interviews are quite brief. Mm. I mean, like Bob Newhart, that interview was 11 and a half minutes, and some interviews are even shorter. I mean, like I got to interview Jimmy Carter, mm-hmm. former President Jimmy mm-hmm. Carter, for 8 minutes. Chris Matthews of Hardball, I think, mm-hmm. for 6 minutes. So I feel like I barely clear my throat in 6 minutes. So I would rather talk to someone a little less famous and get to really talk to them. Probably the most wonderful surprise in that respect was that I got to interview Alan Alda. Mm-hmm. And the first time I interviewed him, we got to do a full show, more than 45 minutes. We talked on and on and on and on about it. And that was amazing. And I was very, very grateful that there was that possibility. Also from the classical music world, a very, very famous singer named Jesse Norman. I had to go through all kinds of hoops to arrange an interview about her autobiography. And she wanted a list of questions and this and that. And I could just tell from all this stuff from her manager that she was very nervous, did not enjoy doing press at all. So I was really concerned that, you know, that was going to be a short, difficult interview. We got on the phone and we talked and talked and talked and talked. I talked with her for more than an hour. I mean, I couldn't use the whole interview. So once in a while, you talk to somebody quite famous and they have all the time in the world. And sometimes they come to the station because they're in town. Mm-hmm. Two that come to mind, Sergei Khrushchev, the son of Nikita Khrushchev, and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, one of the daughters of Robert F. Kennedy. They were both visitors to Carthage and came to the morning show as part of their visit to Carthage. And so I had them face to face in the studio for an entire show. Steve Allen, Art Linkletter, or two others that come to mind that were special guests of Carthage. And I got to speak with them as part of the morning show. So, but most of the time with famous people, it's a little bit rushed, which is always frustrating.
Sure. Does your connection at Carthage, it sounds like it, that provides an opportunity to connect with people, have people on the show that maybe you otherwise wouldn't have that opportunity?
Yes, that does often happen, and not always. I mean, sometimes their visit gets arranged and planned, and there's just no time. And sometimes the person just isn't interested in doing that kind of thing, and that's okay, too. So when Coretta Scott King came to Carthage, for whatever reason, it apparently wasn't even a possibility for her to do the morning show, which, of course, would have been a thrill for me. Sure. But I got to talk on the phone with Julie Nixon Eisenhower before she came to Carthage and other opportunities, too. And in many cases, too, some of those special guests aren't even particularly famous, but are still incredibly interesting people. So that's what counts the most, as far as I'm concerned.
Kind of back to that split brain discussion we had a few minutes ago. Do you find that you have more opportunities for people who would like to be on the morning show? Where how do you kind of filter out and say, this would be a great interview, this one I may have to politely decline? Do you have to do that?
Yes. I should say that most of the time I'm in with authors, for instance, I'm dealing with agents. So it's not that an author contacts me directly. Very seldom does that happen. And once in a while, I say yes to an interview, even if I don't think the book is all that great, because the agent will make it pretty clear that I would really appreciate it if you would do this. So maybe it's somebody where they're having trouble booking other hosts and so on. Particularly with certain agents who have given me really wonderful guests, I will do that every so often. Most of the time, once upon a time, they would send me all the books before I even had booked an interview. And I would get to look at the interview and figure out, oh, yeah, this book is great. That happens less and less. Almost most of the time now, I have to book the interview before I am sent the book. So I have to look at its summary and figure that out. And most of the time, then what I really do is I just make sure it's a reputable publisher. If something is self-published, you just have to be really, really careful. I mean, sometimes those are still great books, but sometimes those self-published books are just a waste of everybody's time. So I value my time and I value our listeners' time. So
how do you balance, Greg, the potential for talking with someone, doing an interview that could be on a somewhat controversial topic? The shows, when I listen to the morning show, you're always pleasant, polite with your guests. But at some time, you're also talking about controversial topics. How do you balance that, staying professional and polite with your interviewee?
That's a really good question. One of the thoughts that comes to mind is this. A lot of times when you ask a difficult or challenging question of a guest, you are, in a sense, doing them a favor, because you are asking them a question, giving them a chance to answer a question that the listener is probably already thinking. And the typical guest appreciates that opportunity. And so that's the way I would typically frame in my own mind a potentially tricky question like that. One thing that comes to mind was a recent conversation about Foxconn. Mm-hmm. And I realized that particularly with public radio listeners, there's a very strong environmental concern that just runs through most public radio listeners. So whenever I have a conversation about Foxconn, even with somebody who is a big Foxconn supporter, I know that I have listeners who have these burning concerns about the environmental impact of Foxconn. Mm-hmm. And it behooves me on behalf of those listeners to ask those questions. And it's better for the guest to have an opportunity to try to address some of those concerns. Otherwise, those concerns have no reason to abate, mm-hmm. but if anything, to just grow. So I think in at least most cases, those challenging questions can serve a very constructive purpose for the guest. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the best kind of challenging question to ask versus a challenging question just to trip someone up or make them feel bad or look bad. I'm not interested in that.
Sure. You're very involved with education and the arts throughout the community. What are some of your favorite things to be involved with? That might be a tricky question there, but what are some of your favorite community events, art events that you're involved with?
Well, first of all, I want to say that one of the reasons I got this job back in 1986, it's not because I was the most experienced of the many applicants that they received from across the country, actually, but I was someone who they knew would be active in the community because I was a musician, and they just could tell from talking to me that this would be important to me. And my predecessor in the job, Art Jones, was a very potent presence in the community. And so I took that responsibility very seriously right from the start. I think I especially love doing things like the Kenosha Pops Band in Panoia Park all summer long, because I know that there are a few WGTD listeners out there, but I think the majority of that audience are not listening to the morning show. And so it's a way for me to connect with another kind of facet of the Kenosha community. And I really appreciate that opportunity. I am the pianist for all the choir concerts at Tremper High School, where my sister-in-law, Polly Amborn, is the choir director. And I love that opportunity to kind of work with young musicians. I teach a lot of voice lessons to especially young men in the community who are interested in being better singers. I am the music director for most of the musicals at the Racine Theater Guild, and that's a really wonderful opportunity to work with a lot of different people. And I've done some really fun things here at UW Parkside, and including the dedication of the Rita.
Right.
I was so honored that I was asked to be the master ceremonies for that dedication ceremony. And I remember saying in those remarks, that's the one time I varied from the script when I said, when I first got this invitation, I thought, this makes no sense. I mean, there's all kinds of people here at Parkside that could do this. And then I realized it makes all the sense in the world, because Parkside has always been so much about outreach into the community. Right. And it just made sense for this Rita facility that was going to be inviting the community in all over the place for someone not part of Parkside to kind of figure in the proceedings. So I love that about Parkside, and so that ranks really high on my list of favorite memories.
And that's the word regional in the Rita Talent Pickin Regional Center for Arts and Humanities. You know, the good thing the building is a big building, because it took some space to get that name on.
Right, right.
But what do you like best about southeastern Wisconsin?
Ah, well, first of all, I guess I love the relative that Kenosha and Racine each are relatively modest-sized cities, but you put them together and you really have something substantial there between the two of them. And yet they're not so big that you feel dwarfed. That, for instance, they both have symphonies, but the symphonies are small enough and local enough that once in a while I get to sing with those symphonies. I mean, if I lived in Milwaukee, I wouldn't be singing with the Milwaukee Symphony. Mm-hmm. And they have community theaters, and you can actually be in those community theaters. And if you live in Milwaukee, you're not just waltzing onto the stage of the Milwaukee Rep. I mean, that's a professional company. So it's big enough for these things to exist, but small enough that we each can be a meaningful part of those arts organizations. And then at the same time, there's Milwaukee right there and Chicago right there. I mean, right between us. And so we have access to those magnificent cities and all that they have to offer. So in my mind, this is the best of everything. I love living here. I wouldn't want to live anyplace else.
Mm-hmm. And as someone who's lived in the area for quite some time, and I've lived in the area for quite some time, it seems that the two communities are doing more together than they possibly have in the past, that they continue to work together and do different things together.
It's absolutely right. I remember when I first came here that Racine and Kenosha, at least as far as lots of people were concerned, were like two different planets.
Yep.
And it depended on who you talk to in certain generations, especially yeah. once upon a time, there was great wariness between Kenosha and Racine. And a lot of those barriers have broken down. I mean, more and more people are like me, where I live in Racine, but I work in Kenosha and back and forth. And I love being a part of both communities. I really, really do. And I think you're correct that more and more cooperation is occurring between the cities. And we're thinking of ourselves regionally a little bit more. The boundaries just don't seem to matter as much. In fact, those boundaries just don't exist the way they once did. So right. I find that to be really encouraging. And I also like to think that both Parkside and Carthage, and Gateway for that matter, have all played a role in sort of mm-hmm. tying these yeah. communities together a little bit more.
Right. And I look at the media side of it, thinking back to as a very young person and making that incredible 10-mile drive from Racine to visit my grandparents in Kenosha. And that was like a Sunday afternoon. You know, I think you had to pack the car and put a cooler in and all those things to get down there. But we'd get to my grandparents' house, and now I'm watching Chicago television because the antenna on top of the house could get Chicago television at our house and my grandparents in Racine. I watched Milwaukee television. And right. so it was really like a different kind of setting from a media side.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And of course, both cities had very different personalities and kind of different societal makeup in a lot of different ways. But I think that also has really changed a lot. I remember when I first started at WGTD, the first time we had a big staff retreat, we had one of those sessions where you list all your strengths and all your weaknesses and all that stuff. And one of the big strengths was that we serve Kenosha and Racine. I mean, that was both in our station IDs and everything. And you know, how great that we cover Kenosha and Racine and all that's going on.
Right.
So then it came time to let's list our weaknesses or challenges or whatever. And I remember Barb Axelson raised her. I said, that we serve both Kenosha and Racine. I mean, she's just verbatim, but it's true. There is also something to be said for the stiff challenge of understanding both communities and covering them thoroughly and understanding them. That's no small feat.
Right. Right. No, that's true. So like I've heard you say, when I've had the pleasure to be on the morning show, the time always goes by more quickly than you anticipate. So I'll throw one last question out for you. I was looking at your website, saw all kinds of pictures of, I think it's Mabel, correct?
Our new puppy, Mabel, yes.
New puppy, yeah. So tell us about Mabel.
We got Mabel in early March, and actually we love having a puppy. She's a golden retriever, and we also have a 15-year-old golden retriever named Ellie. So we are very relieved that they get to coexist as peacefully as they do. And Mabel is calming down a little, and I've had quite a writer's block. I've not written a blog in quite a few weeks because I just feel up to my eyeballs in dealing with Mabel. But she's starting to be a little more self-sufficient, a little calmer, a little quieter. So I'm hoping now this summer I'm going to be able to start blogging again and composing music again and feel like life's a little more more normal. My wife is working full time, and so while Carthage now is on summer break,
right.
I'm the house dad. I'm taking care of Mabel most of the time, and it's a joy.
Excellent. And looking at on the Messy Professor and looking at the blog, the writing is outstanding. Your performances in our community are outstanding. The morning show is outstanding. We're lucky to have you here, and we're lucky to have you on Parkside today because I know that we're taking time from what is a very busy schedule. So, Greg Berg, thank you for being with us today.
I'm truly honored and pleased that you invited me. This was a great pleasure. Anytime.